It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Have you ever tried to learn a new language? Maybe you did it in school. Maybe you're in the process of learning one right now. Even if it was a challenge, research from around the world shows it's worth the effort. Being multilingual can boost everything from our creativity and critical thinking to our cognitive health. Our next guest has spent years studying the connection between language and the brain, and that's the subject of her new book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up with more than one language? Have you taken language classes as a kid or a grown-up? What was the best way for you to learn that second language? Did it come naturally? Or are you like me, and it's tough to learn another language? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Viorica Marianne is the Ralph and Jean Sundin Endowed Professor of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northwestern University. She's the author of the new book, The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. Viorica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Before we dig into the benefits of learning more languages, this is your life's work in a lot of ways. What is it that you find so fascinating about the connection between language and our brains?
I've always loved languages and been interested in the relationship between language and mind. I think most people think about us, our brains producing language, and don't understand that this relationship between language and mind is bidirectional. The languages we use also shape the way we think, shape our minds and our brains. So growing up with more than one language, I've always been interested in this relationship between mind and language.
Let's talk a little bit about how our brain handles language. There was some thought, I think, that, hey, here's a language center for our brains. And as we like analyze and scan our brains, we're going to figure out where language is coming from. If I'm reading you right, Viorica, it's a lot more complicated than that. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. So I actually myself, when I first started, was, you know, almost 30 years ago, was interested in seeing whether one language is located in one part of the brain and another language in another part of the brain. And that's a question I get asked often. But it turns out the brain is a much more distributed network of processing. So both languages share much of this network, and language itself is this broad network of activation in various areas of the brain that change depending on whether we comprehend language, produce language, whether we're focusing on meaning or form or syntax. So it's really a very complex neural activity.
Now, a lot of the history of the study of language has been on people who maybe speak only one language, like me. You and some of your colleagues are expanding that. What kind of things are we starting to learn about language by studying people like you who grew up with more than one language?
Well, you know, I think that if we only study monolingual brains and monolingual minds, we're missing a big part of the picture. And we're getting an incomplete and really inaccurate understanding of the human potential, of the potential of the human mind. And I think about this as being similar to how in the field of medicine, heart disease at one point was studied only in men and later found to be manifesting differently in women, or diabetes was studied primarily in white populations, only to later discover that the indigenous populations of North and South America process sugar differently. In the same way, if we only study monolingual brains, we are really leaving out a lot of important information out. And especially considering that, in fact, the majority of the world's population outside the United States is bilingual and multilingual. So it's very, very common in many countries all around the world to grow up with more than one language. And even in the United States, those numbers are changing. So it is increasingly becoming important to not limit our research to a very small, narrow subset of what are called weird populations that represent only a small, so weird because they are coming from white, educated, industrialized, and rich democratic nations, which are the minority of the world's population. So in order to really understand the human mind, the human potential, we need to expand our definition of that.
Talking to Viorica Marianne, Her new book is called The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're trying to learn a new language right now, we'd love to hear about that. If you grew up speaking more than one language, what was that like for you? How did it shape the way you think, or the way you think you think? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's get into multilingual people here, Viorica. And one thing people might wonder about is for kids, the worry, and I wondered about this too, the worry that, okay, if a kid is brought up with two languages at the same time, are they going to be confused? Is it going to slow down their language growth? You have a pretty solid answer on this one in the book.
Yeah, that's a very common misconception. We often think that, and even advise people not to raise children with more than one language. And there is absolutely no evidence for that. Our human brain is built to be able to handle multiple codes of communication. And if you think of codes of communication as going beyond language and including other symbolic systems like math, like music, like nonverbal communication, you can see that the brain is able to seamlessly learn and integrate and master all these forms of communication. So multiple natural languages can be accommodated just as well. And you can see this in children and in infants all around the world growing up with multiple languages. And in the United States, we often see differences across social economic classes. So upper classes, upper middle classes usually understand the benefit of raising children with multiple languages, and often, sign them up for lessons, language lessons, or hire tutors, or send them on programs abroad, and really understand that being bilingual and multilingual has all these benefits, economic benefits, social benefits, lifelong wonderful outcomes, and encourage that. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we often have groups that are the lowest social economic status that are actively discouraged from speaking another language under the assumption that that's damaging or confusing or bad for them. And there is, again, no evidence for that. And a lot of those recommendations come from biases that are really rooted in something else rather than really language.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Coon Valley. Susan, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Susan?
Well, I'm just curious what your speaker's advice would be about the older people. I'm talking about retired people. What would be the best way for them to learn another language? Because there's many of us who did not have language when we were younger, variations of language. So I'm wondering what she thinks is the best route to go to learn another language.
Great question, Susan. Viorica, what advice do you have for Susan?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up this topic, Susan. It's actually an excellent topic. And before I go into the how, if you would let me, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the benefits for aging,
please.
And the aging brain. Yeah, so we now know that individuals who know two or more languages tend to develop dementia, Alzheimer's, and other types of dementia on average 4 to 6 years later than individuals who only speak one language. And countries that are bilingual or multilingual have a lower incidence of Alzheimer's. So it really does seem to be the case that having multiple languages and giving your brain this constant workout of juggling multiple languages translates to positive neural and cognitive health outcomes later in life, what's known as cognitive reserve and neural reserve. And the analogy I like to give is if you imagine taking a certain road home every day for many years, and then one day on your way home, that road collapses. If there are other roads that have been built to your house over the years, you will have no problem rerouting and getting to your destination. But if that's the only road that has been built, then you are in trouble. And in the same way, when you have multiple languages, if one neural pathway in the brain has been impacted and is no longer available to you, because you have multiple languages that have built memories, associations, experiences over the years, you are able to rely and compensate functionally for that anatomical deterioration. So it's a wonderful thing to learn another language as you get older. As far as how to do it, the one thing I would say is to choose something that you can engage in long-term, every day, systematically. So you, it's something that's sustainable. And then from there, choose a way that works best for your personality. Some people prefer to engage in social interaction on learning language. So maybe trade language lessons with someone. Some people prefer to do it on their own online. You can also trade language lessons online or use apps. There is a really variety of apps right now that are built in a way that takes advantage of game design and rewards learning with all sorts of badges and pings and really gets the serotonin and endorphins and all the positive chemicals going, so you are motivated and inclined to keep up with your lessons. So whatever really is likely to get you to continue and stay with your practice will be very helpful. Make sure you do it regularly, and from there on, the only other thing to consider is just really think about what language you are most likely to find an affinity for. Is this a language that maybe means something for you because of your personal and family background, or because you have people you'd like to communicate with in that language, or you'd like to travel to that country, or you'd like to watch entertainment, consume entertainment in that language? So if you have something to which you're connected and you do this because you enjoy it rather than yet another thing to do, if you make it an enjoyable, pleasant activity, then you're much more likely to stick with it. And that's what it comes down to, like exercise or investing or anything else. If you do it long term, little by little, it's eventually going to produce the benefits that you're looking for.
Susan, thanks for calling. Hope that helps. We're talking to Viorica Marianne, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University. She's the author of the new book, The Power of Language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about speaking more than one language. If you do personally speak more than one, when and how did you learn them? Did you grow up, or did you learn them in school or on the job or in a foreign country? Let us know. If you're like me and tried and, you know, only sort of succeeded, you could share that story too. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Viorica Marianne, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University, talking with her about her new book. It's called The Power of Language, about language, our brains, and the benefits of learning a second or third or fourth language. You could join in with your own story or your questions at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hi. Just wanted to let you know that in Milwaukee, for many years now, at least since the early 90s when my kids started going to these schools, we have at least four language immersion schools, Italian, I believe, German, French, and Spanish. And they learn in four-year-old kindergarten, five-year-old kindergarten, first and second grade. I believe they're only taught in the second language, whether it's German or Spanish or French. And then they're taught in both languages. And they learn to speak, to communicate with the teacher in the second language. And then when they're tested at the fourth grade for the reading levels, they score way at the top, if not first place.
Wow.
In the state or score. So you don't have to worry about them having problems later in learning, because they learn very well.
I gotcha, Mike. Thanks for that call. Viorica, in our schools here in the U.S., often you don't have a foreign language option until high school. Some people like me don't hit one until college. What do you think of this idea, like as Mike talks about, starting early, much earlier, with something like an immersion school?
Yeah, there are multiple types of bilingual education, but the two-way immersion approach that Mike just mentioned is one of the best ways to bring up children with multiple languages. And by the end, they are fluent in both languages. And Mike is right. There are data suggesting that they score higher on reading and math scores, and this is true for both students from the language majority culture as well as for students from the language minority culture. So you see academic benefits, but you also see social, interpersonal, and personal benefits in terms of interpersonal skills, identity, self-confidence. It just seems to be a really beneficial way of raising children with two languages. And results in fluency. So it's a wonderful model. It's very rare because it's more expensive to support, but it is absolutely an excellent way of growing up with two languages. And like we said before, in many countries around the world, it's the norm to grow up with more than one language. So my native language is Romanian. That's the language I spoke at home. And then the official language at the time I was growing up, because it was, I'm from the eastern part of Romania, from Moldova, that was a Soviet republic. It was a Soviet territory. So Russian was the official language. And then English. And then a few other languages sort of get picked up. And then on my husband's side of the family, he grew up with Dutch as the native language, but also is fluent in English, German, some Spanish, some French. And that's really the norm in many places. So it can be a really enriching, both linguistically and culturally and interpersonally, experience.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Before I go back to our callers, Eureka, that you just reminded me of something that I think I learned from your book. You know, the second language is one thing, but that makes it easier to learn language number three, and then that makes it easier to learn language number four. Do I have that right?
Yes, you're right. With each new language you learn, it becomes easier and easier to learn more languages.
Why?
We don't exactly know. There are a number of ideas and theories. Partly it's because you just get better at learning, you know what to pay attention to. You also are better at controlling competition from the languages you already know and interference. But also with each new language, you have less new information to learn. So when you first learn a new language, there's just so much to learn from, you know, rules of grammar and meaning and form to meaning mapping. Then when you learn a second language, some of those grammatical rules are going to be the same. So you do learn, and even some words will be the same. So you learn new information, but not as much as the first time around. And then as you learn a third language, this third language will overlap in some ways with the first language, in some ways with the second language, in some ways with both. So if you think of it in terms of Venn diagrams, with each new language, your total surface of the Venn diagram circles grows, but the unique surface that's specific to just one of those circles becomes smaller and smaller. So learning promotes learning, and with new learning, you sort of become better at learning. It's not just for language in general. Sort of learning is this virtuous cycle. The more you learn, the better you get at learning.
Talking to Eureka Marian about her new book, The Power of Language. Back to your calls now. Robin is with us in Delafield. Robin, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about?
I just want to say I am 56, and I have a daughter who has lived in Sweden for 6 years. She's now a Swedish citizen, and I decided about a year ago to start studying Swedish. And it's just been, it's like, I consider it like my brain workout. it's been so challenging, but it's like in a really good way and frustrating too at times, just because when you just talked about learning other languages, literally there are times when I answer questions in my class, just like yes or no questions, I tap into my high school Spanish. It's hilarious, like what it starts to unlock in your brain when you do learn other languages, like other things pop up. But I have to say, I am all for learning other languages because, like you just said, it is such a good thing for our overall learning. And I feel like it's keeping me younger. And then it's also just providing me a level of comfort. You know, when I travel to visit my daughter, everyone speaks English in Sweden. But, you know, the whole culture and everything in writing is in Swedish. So it's just kind of a nice thing to have.
Robin, thanks so much for sharing that story. Eureka, Robin says her Spanish pops back when she's learning Swedish. I had that. I was never so good at German as when I was trying to learn Polish. What's happening in our brains when we're reaching for that new language we're trying to learn and it reaches back to that one we tried to learn before?
Yeah, thanks. And Robin's experience is wonderful to hear about. She is right to describe that's the word she used, brain workout. And that's exactly really, in a way, what happens. Your brain has to constantly work out to control competition from all these languages to make sure that you are using the language you need to be using and not the other languages. Cognitive, like right now I'm speaking to you in English, I have to make sure my cognitive control mechanisms doesn't let Romanian or Russian or French or Spanish pop out, because they don't do us any good. So your brain is constantly working out, and what's really nice about that is that unlike other types of cognitive exercise that people often engage in, like word puzzles or Sudoku, which, you know, of course, are wonderful and fun. In those cases, you have to take time out of your life to actively do those. But once you're fluent in another language, your brain constantly gets that exercise just by your way of being in the world, because you're constantly facilitating or co-activating, you know, prioritizing one language and then controlling interference from the other language. Whether you are speaking, listening to music, reading, whatever you are doing, you have to juggle multiple languages. So it's a constant workout, which is why it's just such an enriching experience. But yes, Robin is right that all languages are co-activated in parallel. So our brain has to make sure it controls co-activation.
Thanks for that call, Robin. Just briefly, Viorica, you talk about languages. You know, we think of English and Swedish and Spanish and so on. But you also talk about music and computer programming and poetry as kinds of language. In just our last minute, how do they resemble those other things we think of as languages?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, of course, they are different in so many ways. But one thing that they have in common is that they're all symbolic systems. They all use symbols, which is what languages are, to encode, transmit, and decode information. As I'm speaking to you now, my brain uses the symbolic system of language to encode my ideas, to encode my thoughts into words, transmit them to you, and then your brain decodes them into ideas again and thoughts to be able to comprehend what I'm saying. The same thing happens with math, where we encode complex ideas into simple notations, with music to really transmit information across time and space. So that's one of the wonderful things that languages enable us to do, including artificial languages like computer languages.
Viorica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure to talk to you and your listeners.
That's Viorica Marian, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University. We've been talking about her new book. It's called The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. End-of-life decision-making can be difficult and emotionally challenging, whether we're making our own decisions or making them for or along with a loved one. One big question, how aggressive should medical care be in the last days or weeks of life? Our next guest has followed that issue, including a new study that finds that aggressive medical care is fairly common for people in the latest stages of terminal cancer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had this experience recently in your own family, something you'd be comfortable sharing about? Did the person get the care they wanted and not get the care that they didn't want? What questions do you have about end-of-life care and these difficult conversations with family members and healthcare providers? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Paula Spann is a journalist who writes columns for the New York Times called The New Old Age and Generation Grandparent. She's the author of the book When the Time Comes, Families with Aging Parents Share Their Struggles and Solutions, and she teaches in the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Her recent piece for the Times is called Aggressive Medical Care Remains Common at Life's End. Paula, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be with you, Rob.
You've been talking about these issues for a long time. I want to start with your piece on this more recent study focusing on cancer patients and the treatment they get. What were researchers looking at, and what did they find?
Well, just as background, people have been working for years to try to reduce aggressive care at the end of life. It's not what patients say they want. They don't want to die in hospitals. They don't want to be kept alive by machines in general. They want a peaceful passage. And so for the Medicare approved coverage of hospice care 40 years ago, 1983. So I was interested to see that in this new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, these researchers at Case Western Reserve School of Medicine found that the amount of aggressive care was still so high. These were patients who were in the last 30 days of their lives, and they had metastatic cancer. That means cancer that has spread. So these were people who were not going to recover. And yet, 58% of them who were just older people living in the community, these were all Medicare beneficiaries, 58% of them got aggressive care in the end of life. And if they were nursing home residents, it was 64%. And aggressive care in this case means things like, were they being treated for their cancer? Were they getting surgery or radiation or chemotherapy? Were they being sent to the emergency room? Were they being sent to the ICU? Were they enrolled in hospice in time for hospice to really support them? So it's discouraging that after all these years, this is still the case for this population, which was so clearly at the brink of death.
And to put some names and faces on this, you start your piece looking at an example. You talked to someone named Jennifer O'Brien about a story from her family and her father. Can you tell us what she shared with you?
Sure. So her father, Jennifer O'Brien, lives in Little Rock, Arkansas. Her father, who was 84, a very independent guy, lived alone in rural New Mexico, said he didn't need any help. But a neighbor found him on the floor with a broken hip and called an ambulance. So Mr. O'Brien was already in very poor health. He had heart failure. He was a smoker, so he had advanced lung disease. He needed a walker for a spinal injury. He was so short of breath that he had to use a thing called a BiPAP, which is a kind of a portable ventilator with a tight mask over your face. And he had to wear it all the time, except when he was eating. So when he was in the hospital and Jennifer became involved in his care, the surgeons wanted to repair his hip. And that's a big repair. That's a big operation to repair a hip. And this was a person who was very close to dying, but he was mentally competent to make his own decisions. So when his daughter said to him on the phone with a palliative care nurse practitioner, "Dad, your heart and your lungs are just done," he decided, no, he did not want to undergo this surgery. The anesthesia is dangerous to older people. The inability to move around is dangerous to old people. Hospitals themselves are often dangerous to old people. He decided against having the repair. The doctors were upset, called Jennifer thinking, well, you can talk him into it. She said she declined to do that. And she called a hospice, and he died in a few days. And she went to see him, and she was with him at the end. But he declined to undergo aggressive care. But he was able to make his own decisions. Oftentimes, it's families that are making these decisions for people, and that can be where a lot of the problem arises.
Talking to Paula Spann with the New York Times, she wrote a recent piece on aggressive end-of-life care. Sometimes, if it's not what the patient wants, what their family wants, or if it's the best call for a patient, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Pretty much every family is going to go through a moment like this at some point. Maybe you have an experience to share with us from your own family. If you're looking at this from the healthcare provider perspective, love to hear what you've seen as well. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Serena is with us in Menominee. Serena, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us, Serena?
So I went through, I guess you'd say, a hospice care with my aunt. So previously, she had gone through so many doctors. She had so much wrong with her. She had lupus, osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis. You pretty much name it, she had it. And so what had happened is one toe had been slammed against, this is where it all started, sorry. And one toe had been slammed up against something, and it ended up dying, so they had to remove the toe. And then that caused an infection in her leg. She had to have one leg removed. And then the other toe, the big toe on the other leg, died. It just, there was no rhyme or reason for it. It just happened. And then they found out that her neuropathy had gotten so bad that there was no, like, massive blood flow to her leg. So she had to have the other leg removed. And after that, like, it went downhill pretty quickly. And she had decided on her own to go into hospice care. And I asked her probably about a week after she had signed the papers that I'm like, why are you doing this? What is wrong? You know, what can I help with? She's like, I'm just sick of being in pain. And to me, that was an acceptable answer because she's my aunt. I've known her all my life. You know, I took care of her for the last 5 years, taking her to and from every single doctor's appointment from here to Timbuktu. And to me, that was an acceptable answer. And she died a month to the day after signing the hospice paper.
Serena, thanks for sharing your story. Paula, every story is unique, but I think a lot of common themes in there, how people make these difficult decisions. Can you talk a little bit about what we heard from Serena there?
Yeah, Serena, I'm sorry for your loss. Mm-hmm. And you were spent 5 years as a family caregiver. That's a stressful role. But I agree with you that it's a perfectly acceptable answer if a person of any age, but especially an older person who may never recover to be the person they used to be after multiple medical interventions. I think it's acceptable for that person to say, I've had enough. I'm sick of pain. I want a comfortable ending, but I don't want to prolong my life. But I will point out that when we talk about why is there so much aggressive care at the end of life, there's plenty of blame to go around. So you will hear family members often say, these doctors just won't have a frank conversation. We don't even know that someone's dying. They don't know exactly how to say it. They keep suggesting more and more procedures and operations and drugs, and there's always something else to try. And on the other hand, you will hear healthcare professionals say, no, it's the families. The families don't want to let go. The families are saying, do everything possible. We can't let them die. And I think what we all have to remember, regardless of what our role is in this process, is that immortality is not one of our options. We all have to face death, and we should have choices about how to do that. But the idea that we just, that the system has to keep you alive at all costs, puts you on this kind of medical conveyor belt that your aunt was on, where there's, you do this and then you do that, and then this problem arises, so then you have to fix that. And I think people have the right to say, I've had enough now, let's stop.
Serena, thanks again for being willing to share that with us. We'll go to Jim now in Menominee Falls. Jim, hi.
Hi. I wanted to share the end of life of my father, which was about a decade ago. He was a family physician and, you know, took care of many patients from birth to death. He really did everything. And when it came time, he was suffering from prostate cancer and a hip replacement and renal failure. And so he knew he was towards the end of life, and he had a shunt put in for dialysis. And I was with him when he went in for the procedure, and he made it very clear to them that this is a DNR, you know, situation. He did not want to be resuscitated. And when they put it in, there was a problem, and his heart stopped. And they brought him back, put him on a ventilator, and they had him on a feeding tube, and they couldn't, you know, because they told me that it was because it was during a surgical procedure, they couldn't, you know, they couldn't do the DNR because we didn't really get a clear answer to that. And so there were long decisions about, you know, how do we do this? Do we, you know, we were the ones that had to, you know, take away the feeding tube, take away the breathing tube. And there was, you know, several days there where, you know, you could tell that the patient was in agony, even though he was in a coma. And it was, you know, it's a horrible situation for anybody, but for a physician who knew everyone, and they still did those things, even though he expressed DNR, you know, that was very troubling.
Jim, I'm sorry you went through that, and thanks for sharing that. Paula, an express decision made, no, there's a do not resuscitate order, but in the heat of surgery, that order is ignored. Is that common?
Oftentimes, if there's a surgical procedure, they do say we revoke your DNR while you're in surgery, and then you can restore it afterwards. It is troubling, Jim, you're right, especially for someone who had foreseen this possibility and thought he had taken a precaution against it. But I would just mention to people who are in the crunch with family members who are near death, but there are all these procedures and operations being proposed, that the magic words in a hospital are, there's two, three. One is palliative care. Palliative care doctors are the ones that help people be comfortable and manage symptoms, but they are not necessarily dealing with curable diseases. And the other is hospice, which is the Medicare-funded program for people at the end of life. And it allows most people in hospice to die at home, which is where they want to be and not in a hospital. When you say palliative care, I want a palliative care consultation, or when you say we want to call hospice, that's kind of a signal to the staff at a medical institution that you understand that death is near and that you're trying to keep this person comfortable. You're trying to give this person a good death, the so-called good death, but you're not expecting miracles, and that you know that immortality is not on the table. So I would just pass this along to listeners to know palliative care and hospice. But Jim, it's infuriating, and I'm just so sorry he had to suffer.
Jim, thanks again for sharing that. We are talking about end-of-life care, why it's sometimes more aggressive than patients and their families want. Journalist and author Paula Spann is with us from the New York Times, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this ringing a bell? Is this something you've been through in your own life, maybe recently with a loved one? If you are a healthcare provider, what do you want patients to know? Do you work in hospice or palliative care? I'd love to hear your perspective as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Paula Spann, journalist and columnist of the New York Times. We're talking about a recent piece she wrote called Aggressive Medical Care Remains Common at Life's End. Before we go back to our callers at 800-642-1234, Paula, you write in your piece that there's one kind of weird thing in the system where Medicare, people receiving Medicare who are in hospice care, sometimes have trouble getting treatment that they could actually use that would be palliative care because of Medicare guidelines. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, it's a little complicated, but basically when you enter hospice care, you give up curative care. So you can still get all kinds of treatments if they help keep you comfortable, but you can't get things like curative surgery for cancer. And so this tends to make certain groups of people reluctant to enroll in hospice in time. And hospice, let me explain, really people should be in hospice care for weeks and months, but the length of stay is very short. People wait till the very last minute, but hospice can do great things for families, give great support, and people shouldn't wait until someone's a week from dying. In this case, there's something called concurrent care, and where you see this is with people who are in kidney failure and they're on dialysis. So if you stop dialysis and you're in kidney failure, you will die in a week to 2 weeks. But the Veterans Affairs healthcare system is more liberal in its criteria than regular hospice. And so through the VA, the people in kidney failure can continue to get what's called palliative dialysis. It controls your symptoms. It helps you feel better, but you don't have to go three times a week for 4 hours. You can do it less often. You can do it for less time. And so those people, I talked about a study done in the VA. When you require people to give up dialysis in order to enter regular Medicare hospice, they die within a week or two. But when you allow them to have concurrent care through the VA, they live for another, let's say, 40 days. I think it was 43. So that gives people time to see family, to see friends, to say goodbye, to, you know, maybe enjoy one more spring or go to a granddaughter's wedding. But more to the point, if people have to give up things that they have come to rely on that make them feel better in order to enter hospice care. Sometimes they just don't. So their Medicare is pilot testing this in several locations, and we may see change on that in the next year or two.
Let's go back to our callers. Rana is with us in Rice Lake. Rana, what did you want to share with us?
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you to your guest. I've cared for both my parents towards their end, and they both had incredibly different end-of-life experiences. My dad moved in with us. We live in an area that has relatively stable health care. We're still rural, but we have people on staff and a good, stable work environment. So when my dad needed hospice, it was available. We had people coming. His end of life was calm and smooth and was what I would have wanted for him. My mom, however, had lived in a much more rural community, had one hospice staff member who was not even from that area, who came from St. Croix Falls to do the hospice work there. That's about a 4.5-hour trip. Hospice and palliative care were so, there was so, the staffing was so short, the communication was so terrible. Some of the staffing came up from Mississippi to work in this care facility because there wasn't enough. My mom was the one in the nursing home yelling, help, help, for 4 months while she died a horrible death. Her sister, who is the POA, couldn't come to terms with mom needing to go on hospice, so she would just allowed mom to suffer terribly, and it was one of the worst experiences I've ever had in my life. I was with my parents both until the end, of course. That's where I needed to be, but I will be forever questioning that particular care facility's abilities to really care for people in their end of life.
Well, Rana, I'm so sorry about that experience, but it raises a big question, Paula. Even if we do agree that we want more people to have more hospice access, do we have the staffing? Do we have the facilities to accommodate that?
Well, hospice has really grown so that the most recent statistics are that now about half of the Medicare recipients who die in most recent year died in hospice care. So it's huge growth. And most places do have at least one, but you want a choice, really, of hospices. But what Rana talks about is a problem with all kinds of healthcare, which is rural areas have trouble getting and keeping personnel. And the distances are so long that it can become economically infeasible. So it is a big problem, not related only to hospice and palliative care, but all kinds of care. I've just recently written about people unrelated to this topic, people who put off having necessary procedures like colonoscopies or cataract surgery because they don't have anyone to pick them up and take them home. And that, you know, when people, 1,000 people wrote in with comments, and one of the refrains was, think about what happens if you're the nearest healthcare, the nearest ambulatory surgical center is a 2-hour drive. It's just, it's a big problem that goes beyond end of life. But Rana, it's a very sad story. I will say that in my own family, we have managed, both my parents and my sister, I have accompanied to their deaths. And this is in New Jersey in each case, and where there's plenty of hospices and plenty of healthcare providers. But you do sometimes have to be the one who stands up and says, you know, I am her surrogate decision maker, and I say, we've had enough. I know what her wishes are. She would not want to live like this. No, we will not consent to this proposed treatment. No, we are calling hospice. And I'm just sorry, Rana, that you were not the person who had that legal authority for your mother, because it sounds like you knew what to do and it couldn't happen. It's a terrible situation.
Rana, thanks again for calling. And Paula, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Paula Spann. She writes the New Old Age and Generation Grandparent columns for the New York Times. We talked with her about a recent piece she wrote headlined, Aggressive Medical Care Remains Common at Life's End. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.